It's time for the Wild Clear Water Country. And we are looking at about 19 degrees, Moscow Pullman Regional. And it looks like it's going to stay pretty chilly and go down to 15 tonight, expected. Get a little warmer tomorrow. Actually going to break 30. Wow. And looks like we're hovering right around 30 and high for the rest of the week. Definite possible chances of snow starting tonight. Very, very likely to snow through Friday. Well, I kind of like that, Gary.
That's good.
That works
good
for
by me.
Yeah.
I've got my studs now once I get my bike fixed after the little accident.
Oh, man. What happened?
Oh, it was one of those things where it came off the bike rack in the car.
Yeah.
We were coming in to run some errands, and Bobby said, "Hey, stick the bike on." And anyway, it went flying on the highway.
Oh, man.
So we have a new tire that needs to be a new wheel.
Yeah, this weather can be hard on bikes anyway, when they're not flying through the air.
I've got my studded snow tires on there and ready to go.
Well, we got an interesting show lined up, looks like. We're going to be talking about, we're going to have the peak of the week.
That's right.
We have a couple quick announcements in just a minute. We're going to be talking about a little bit more about Franklin's Grouse, which we mentioned when we featured Loxa Peak a few weeks back. Franklin Grouse, our subspecies of the spruce grouse. Got a big fat whopper for you, very deserving.
Oh, yes, a very deserving award.
It might spur some more conversation. It probably will. Mm-hmm. We might just kind of end up going into tirades. And a few news blurbs on some pertinent issues. But first, those announcements. Friends of the Clearwater is having their holiday dessert potluck Friday.
That's right.
At Maria Maggi's house, 312 South Asbury, around 7 p.m. And they ask that folks just bring dessert if they can, and favorite warm beverage, and a photograph of their most memorable wildland experience from the past year.
Yeah.
So we can tell tall tales by the fire.
That's right. And if you don't have a photograph, of course, a story will do.
Yes. If it's burned into your brain, that counts.
That's right.
All right. Second announcement, there will be a growth hearing. We're talking about sprawl kind of growth for Moscow Monday, December 4th at the Latah County Courthouse, room 2B. I don't have a time on that. I believe it's in the evening. We'll get a time to you before the end of the show. But that's next Monday, a hearing on growth, kind of a big issue around here right now. In the news, Pacific Northwest states seek authority to kill sea lions eating salmon. The states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on Monday asked the federal government for permission to kill sea lions eating salmon and steelhead at the Bonneville Dam on the Columbia. Lethal removal is a management method we prefer not to use, but one that may be necessary to restore balance to the Columbia River ecosystem. That's according to Guy Norman. And
I have a really good idea about how to restore balance.
I do too, Gary. What do you think?
Well, I think there's a bunch of cement plugs in the Columbia River that caused this problem in the first place, because all the salmon and steelhead go to one little teeny. It's probably about, as I recall, sometimes about 6 feet wide ladder for all the fish to get up at these dams. 6 feet, 10 feet, I don't know. It seems to be they're about 6 feet, one of the ones I've seen. It seems like we can remove those big cement plugs.
I have a feeling you're right. And, you know, slapping Band-Aids on top of Band-Aids to fix this problem. Yeah, fish and wildlife agencies from the three states joined to formally seek permission. They've been talking about this for a while because they have to subvert the Marine Mammal Protection Act to do it. So they're trying to get federal permission to do so. And there's also a bill in Congress to also give permits to kill problem sea lions to the states and Indian tribes.
Well, so that's kind of interesting, because they might start shooting them elsewhere, because I understand they're just right there on the last dam. Is that Bonneville Dam, as I recall? It's the lowest one down there.
That's right.
And sitting there right in the fish ladder. So I think that's... We could solve that problem pretty easily.
I think so. Okay, other news. two other news blurbs for you. Craig, this is hot off the press. Senator Larry Craig wants pay before protect language in Idaho wildland bills. Out of Boise on the AP, a national environmental group says it will not accept a demand by Idaho Republican Senator Larry Craig concerning the two Idaho wilderness bills currently before Congress, those being CEDRA for the Boulder White Clouds and the Owyhee Canyonlands bill. Craig wants to require that all the money needed to designate such wilderness be provided before the bills become law. Craig Gerke of the Wilderness Society, which helped write both bills, say such bills set a bad precedent.
Well, those bills set a bad precedent, but I've never, and that probably may not be such a good precedent, though, but there's other really even probably worse precedents in those bills, so it looks like they're not going to pass anyway.
Yeah, it looks like they won't pass this
time,
session.
So if they want to get them through and have real wilderness protection, well, there's an opportunity in the next Congress, maybe with the changes that have been made. Those might be possible. Who knows?
Yeah, I think so. Craig also says he's working on changing the Owyhee and Boulder White Clouds to ensure ranchers and others who are promised money and compensation are paid before the wilderness is designated.
You know, that's kind of weird because in the Owyhees, I thought that this compensation was going to be sort of a land swap, land trades, or if they wanted to get paid, there was a measure in here. Now, one of the problems with it was it forced the government to give up a bunch of money if ranchers want to, quote, either sell land or sell what is called interests, grazing permits, which technically have no legal value. So it's just kind of another way to fleece the taxpayer, sounds like.
Officials investigating two wolf kills in the region. Two wolves in the Clearwater region of north central Idaho in November, and also a couple of cow kills as well. The radio collar from the alpha male of the O'Hara Point pack was found and turned in by a deer hunter this November. The pack roams the South Fork of the Clearwater, and the wolf was last located alive in October of 2004. This collar has been turned over to Fish and Wildlife Service law enforcement, and it's under investigation. An untagged adult female gray wolf was found killed south of Grangeville on November 19th. Her death is also under investigation. The total documented wolf mortality, including all causes, is 60 so far this year in Idaho.
60 dead wolves.
Yeah.
About 10% of the estimate there, of the estimated population.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Gary.
And that's known.
That's not a small amount.
That's a small number, and that's known.
Right, exactly.
That's known, documented.
There already is population control in effect, isn't
there?
That's
right. Interesting.
Mm-hmm. That is. We're going to go to a quick musical break, and we're going to be back, and we're going to talk about... I think we're going to talk about maybe some weeds and some...
Yeah, we're going to talk a little about
some
weeds.
Peaks.
And weeds and peaks.
Stay with us.
Grew up dreaming of being a cowboy and loving the cowboy ways, pursuing the life of my high-riding heroes. I burned up my childhood days. I learned all the rules of a modern day drifter. Don't you hold on to nothing too long. Just take what you need from the ladies that leave them with the words of a sad country song. My heroes have always been cowboys. Still are, it seems, sadly in search of, and one step in back of themselves and their slow moving dreams. Cowboys are special with their own brand of misery from being alone. Die from the cold in the arms of a madman, knowing well that that your best days are gone. Picking up hookers instead of my pen, I let the words of my youth fade away. Old worn out saddles and old worn out memories, but no one and no place to stay. My heroes have always been cowboys, and they still are, it seems. Sadly in search of, and one step and back off, themselves and their slow moving dreams. Sadly in search of, and one step and back of, themselves and their slow moving dreams.
Welcome back to the Wild Clearwater Country. Well, Gary.
Well, there's another little announcement I think people ought to be aware of. The Forest Service is undertaking an environmental impact statement, a study on weeds inside the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness. And the first round of public involvement, what they call scoping, those comments are due in a couple days. And if people are interested, they can send in their comments to comments-northern-clearwater-locksaw. Those dashes are single dashes, so it's all one when there's no space between the two. So comments-northern-clearwater, one word, locksaw, at fs.fed.us. And that stands for Forest Service Federal Government.us. And in the subject line, put Selway Bitterroot weeds. Comments are due on the 1st of December. This is kind of an interesting topic. Forest Service, for whatever reason, has decided that they need to do something now about weeds inside the Selway Bitterroot Wilderness when there's been almost nothing done to prevent weeds getting in the first place. And some of the very controversial methods include introduction of non-native species insects and to eat the weeds. The problem is that some of the endangered plants and rare plants in the West may be similar to some of the weeds, and they found that actually in Hell's Canyon with some of the introduced insects. So that's really a concern. We're introducing now a species inside the wilderness, an area that's supposed to basically allow the natural processes to take place. Nature to call the shots, and yeah, weeds are there, but that's a change in the landscape. Change occurs all the time. Another controversial method is, of course, the spraying of herbicides, going in there with sprayers and spray herbicides. But nothing in this project talks about prevention and how to prevent weeds and preventing their spread. So that, I think, is the biggest downfall of this proposal. But if people are interested, again, you can send the comments to comments-northern-clearwater-locksaw at fs.fed.us, or you can visit the Friends of the Clearwater website. I think we'll have some information about this, or give them a call at 882-9755. So, I mean, that's interesting. We're talking about herbicides and spraying, and that's going to fit in a little bit later to a topic we're going to discuss about later. But
that is interesting timing.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think people need to really think seriously about whether or not it makes sense for us to trample or try to control the wilderness from the inside, even though it may be an undesirable thing occurring. And, you know, what we do, and is there a provision in the law to do that? And do we want to be continually spraying herbicides into some of our wildest areas? I mean, those are some serious questions that we need to ask. It's true that weeds are there, and there is a problem. Maybe something should have been done far earlier. I think prevention should have been undertaken, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago when this happened. But the Forest Service did nothing and let the some of the natural values be diminished by those weeds. But now, you know, so we're sort of in a no-win situation here. I think that we need to seriously look at, prevention. And, this is an interesting opportunity to see what will happen, natural processes that take place when an invasive plant is introduced into an area. And these kind of changes do take place all the time in nature. But just kind of see what happens. But spraying weeds in here in a continual program of weed spraying may not solve anything. In fact,
you're right. It might not solve anything at all.
At all. In fact, just may perpetuate the problem. I would argue that things like spotted knapweed, places where we spray everywhere, they're abundant in the Bitterroot Valley, for example, Montana. And that's how they got in the Selway Bitterroot. People think it's coming over Nez Perce Pass and down the Selway River and up the Selway River. So they're abundant everywhere, and they're sprayed. I mean, that areas are sprayed all the time. So it really hasn't done anything. So I think that's a real question, a real issue that people need to think about. And I would also ask the Forest Service to ask this question of themselves. What provision in the Wilderness Act allows them to go in and spray or introduce non-native species? I would actually suggest that the Act would look askance at such things and would want us to prevent weeds from being established in the first place. And because the Forest Service in the past, their erroneous and poor stewardship of the wilderness allowed weeds to get established by emphasizing wilderness as a recreation place rather than as a wildland resource.
And my question, Gary, is the good we could do by attempting even to curtail this weed proliferation anywhere on par with the preventing the bad that would come from spraying pesticides?
I think that's really the question that the Forest Service has to
Do you know if there's any data on the threat that weeds pose to native species, for example?
I mean, in some places it's fairly significant, but I think an interesting thing about this part of the world, and we'll see what happens, is some people think that spotted knapweed is actually in part responsible for keeping down another weed that may have as big or bigger ecological problems, and that's cheatgrass, which is a much more established plant. It's been around here for much longer. And so, those are interesting questions. Cheatgrass has a very profound effect on fire ecology, making it very, very easy to burn, and fire becoming much, much more frequent in some of those lower break, ponderosa prime break lands of the Selway River. And there's quite a bit, about 100,000 acres, which amounts to less than 10% of the wilderness, but that's what they estimate right now, that has some form of weeds on them or not. So it's a big area, and I don't know if you can really do that, and who knows if it would work anyway. So Forest Service is going to take a look at this. I think they should have done some aggressive prevention well before now, and there's some things that still may be able to happen. Of course, one of the things that's less controversial is, of course, the culture, what we call cultural treatment, going in there and pulling them out or taking a hoe and whacking them and things like that. But, that's effective only in certain smaller infestations. Of course, spraying is really hard to do on steep, really steep slopes and things like that. So, there's a lot of question whether or not spraying all this herbicide will do anything. And there is research, however, on the introduction of non-natives that shows that certain species do well at the detriment of other species in ecosystems. And the research that's very specific to spotted knapweed, the one that people really complain about the most, concerns the white-footed deer mouse.
Yes, that's right.
White-footed deer mice do very well because we've introduced an insect, a weevil, that eat some of the seed heads of this plant. But what's happened is we've seen probably a tripling, they estimate, of the white-footed deer mice, and a loss in some other native mice or rodent species out there. And these mice now have greatly increased their numbers because they eat these insects that eat the seed heads. And that also has implications, and they think that's maybe leading to an increase in hantavirus for humans. So, again, these effects, we have a cascading effect by trying to introduce something in the first place.
Yeah. That's so analogous to our discussion on sea lions.
Exactly. You can never do one thing. And I think that's the point. Ecologically, when you try to do something, you can never do one thing. You always have big implications. And what are the implications of doing the one thing? They may even be worse. The cure, you know, may be worse than the disease in this case. So, very interesting topic.
Yeah. Well, we're going to highlight a species this week, our little species spotlight. I'm going to start by reading a little anecdote, and maybe you can guess where this comes from, talking about this species we call the spruce grouse or Franklin's grouse in this region. There is a distinct subspecies of the spruce grouse, known as Franklin's grouse, found in the southwestern portion of the bird's range. Not your typical southwestern portion. The southwestern portion of this bird tends to be Alberta, southerly BC, and northern Idaho. Well, down into southern Idaho is the southwestern portion of the spruce grouse's range. So here's some anecdotal information for you. The large black and white pheasant is peculiar to that portion of the Rocky Mountain watered by the Columbia River. At least we did not see them in these mountains until we reached the waters of that river, nor since have we left those mountains. They are about the size of a well-grown hen. The contour of the bird is much that of the reddish-brown pheasant common to our country. The individual here is referring to the ruffed grouse, which is more common in the eastern United States, which has a reddish-brown tinge, especially in the tail. He continues, the tail is proportionably as long and is composed of 18 feathers of equal length of a uniform dark brown tipped with black. The feathers of the body are of a dark brown, black, and white. The black is that which most predominates, and the white feathers are irregularly intermixed with those of the black and dark brown on every part, but in greater proportion about the neck, breast, and belly. And this quote comes from... Gary?
I bet it comes from the journals.
It does.
Expedition.
Yeah.
200 years ago.
Yep. That comes from the journals of Meriwether Lewis, who's pretty darn good naturalist.
Right.
Which I'm very thankful for, to get some nice detailed descriptions of the creatures that we see 200 years ago. So he was talking about this grouse. And just to give a little history of the name of this species... the taxonomic history real quickly. In 1895, this bird was considered Franklin's grouse, separate from the spruce grouse, which was called Canada grouse back then. Dendragopus canadensis, the tree lover of Canada. And the Franklin's grouse, Dendragopus franklini, was Franklin's tree lover. And in 1910, the name was changed to the Hudsonian spruce partridge. And then in 1931, commonly became the spruce grouse. And Franklin's grouse was also considered a separate species still at that time. And then in 1957, finally, the distinction between the two species was dissolved by ornithologists, and they put them into one species. And more recently, we found that spruce grouse have enough morphological differences and even behavioral differences to warrant at least subspecies designation, the Franklin's grouse. And they do have that subspecies designation today. An interesting note is that up until the late 50s and into the 60s, grouse hunters in the Bitterroot Mountains still called this bird, they called him the Franks. They went Frank hunting.
Uh-huh.
So, kind of neat. They're named after John Franklin, who's an English sea captain and Arctic explorer.
Wow.
Who led an ill-fated expedition to the Northwest Territories in 1819 and trying to find that fabled Northwest Passage. Half of his crew died, but one of his crew members, Sir John Richardson, who happened to be, those explorers back then just kind of baffled me, reading about them always inspires me because they tend to have such broad knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
The surgeon is also, you know, the naturalist.
Right.
That kind of amazes me. So this guy, Sir John Richardson, was the surgeon naturalist, and he named this bird for his captain, John Franklin.
Interesting.
Yeah. Two or three really interesting notes on the Franklin's grouse, or the greater spruce grouse, is that these birds crop. They can store up to 10% of their body weight in food in their crop. And that's...
Well, that's huge.
Yeah, that's important.
That's amazing.
Isn't that amazing?
What do they eat?
They eat mostly... they like a lot of seeds and buds,
mm-hmm.
so they tend to nibble off those any remaining buds on any shrubs
mm-hmm.
and dig through the leaf litter to find more of those kind of material as well. Mostly plant matter, specifically plant matter. This grouse gastrointestinal organs actually change with seasonal shifts in diet. In winter, when the bird must eat more food to maintain its mass and energy balance, its gizzard grows by about 75%, and other sections of the digestive tract increase in length by about 40%.
Wow.
So, really, kind of an amazing animal. Yeah, and just to note again, the main difference between the Franklin's grouse and the spruce grouse is in the tail. The spruce grouse found out of this southwestern part of its range has a rufous tip, all black tail, and is more charcoal dark gray on its back.
Mm-hmm.
Our Franklin's grouse has an all black tail with a row of white spots on the tertials, and it also looks a little more chocolatey, mm-hmm. Dark brown than that charcoal color. So that's our species of the week.
All right. Well, amazing. Well, we'll have to tell a few stories about these critters. Fool's hen, I think, is
the
name
hen.
Ascribed to them.
That's
also,
right.
I've also heard that for the blue grouse for the south as well. But yeah. I'm wondering if maybe in the pre-European settlement times, if maybe the range didn't extend a little further south than what it does today, mm-hmm. Speaking perhaps of some of the higher peaks of the Rockies, say down into Wyoming mm-hmm. and possibly even into Colorado and northeastern Utah. But just a guess, because the term fool's hen, I know, applies to in those places. You'll see many places called Fool's Hen Ridge or Fool's Hen Park
mm.
and things like that. But it may be they're referring to the blue grouse or possibly in some cases perhaps the one of the ptarmigans.
They could be. That's true. And you know
and which is also interesting, the range of ptarmigan, because
yes.
they're not certain that they were in Colorado and northern New Mexico, but I think it's debatable whether they occurred in Wyoming at all and whether they occur mm. in Idaho, and we do know they're in northern Montana. So
that
it's
is.
kind of interesting whether or not they occurred in the high peaks like the Wind Rivers or the Absarokas of Wyoming.
That's
and the Uinta Mountains of Utah. They said they're reintroduced, but those are 14,000 foot mountains, but yet they're found throughout Colorado. And I believe they're probably found on the Beartooth Plateau, though I don't know that, up in Montana, which is right there on the border between Montana and Wyoming. But they were found, we do know that historically, in the Glacier Park, Bob Marshall country up there,
mm.
Along that part of the Continental Divide. And there is an account, I believe, in Burley's book, that they found some on the Bitterroot Crest in the Idaho side.
Mm.
I believe there is one account from Idaho. So
have to look into that. Yeah, that is interesting. Just to give you the lay of the land, if you didn't follow us too well there, gallinaceous birds, we're talking about the grouses and ptarmigan. The ptarmigan are typically all white in the winter, have an incredible molting process that they go through, and are typically found at northern latitudes. But white-tailed ptarmigan is found well south into Colorado in the very high peaks. And the term fool's hen... fool's hen has been applied to spruce grouse because, unlike other grouse, they tend to not flush and move far away when disturbed by humans' presence. And thus, they were named the fool's hen. And I've even heard stories of folks just for fun lassoing them around the neck instead of trying to hunt them with a gun or with a bow and arrow because they're so foolish. They stay really close.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
And of course, for them, not probably being hunted heavily by humans prior to the arrival of Europeans, I'm sure some were, but not that heavily hunted. Evolutionarily, they were adapted to avoid other predators, and that strategy mm-hmm. probably worked well with other predators and maybe not so well with humans. We think they're foolish, fool's sand. But yeah, and that is so true of the Franklin grouse, the Franks, as you call them. Anybody that's hiked at all in the wild Clearwater country, you know, in the Clearwater Basin and the north end of the salmon drainage and the St. Joe country, or even just taking a little short hike east of here on the Palouse River drainage on the Clearwater National Forest, runs into these really, what I think, relatively small. I mean, they're big, but they're small compared to the larger blue grouse, mm-hmm. and they seem smaller than the rough grouse, at least to me. Maybe I'm not right, but they'll just walk on the ground, and they'll try. They think they're being very still, but you can see them there. Pattern recognition being a trait of humans and our brains and eyes, we can see them sometimes there, and maybe other species can't. And you catch just a little glimmer of motion, and then it stops, and they just stay there, and you can see them, and you get right up next to them, and quite the burden. And they have they're trying to creep away from you. They think you're not looking at them, and then they'll do that really soft creeping, and they'll go, you know, maybe 3 feet in about half a minute. It's just that very slow walking and that kind of bobbing. It's really it's funny. And fool's hand, I can see why the early people called them fool's hand.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks to be that they are a tad bit smaller in weight mm-hmm. Than rough grouse, about the same size, length and wingspan, but almost a third of a pound smaller in weight.
Okay.
And if you do see... we do have rough grouse around here as well. So if you hear a burst, if you do hear a burst of fluttering wings, rough grouse kind of rely on surprise,
mm-hmm.
and it really startles you if you don't know they're there when they flush, and then they sail away. And you'll see if you see the rufous adults, which are more common around here, you'll see a very rufous tail, very brown above. Whereas the spruce grouse are a lot darker on top. And blue grouse are pretty large birds, weighing more than twice as much as a spruce grouse.
Right, they're a big bird, a lot larger. And they also are around here.
Rather drab in color.
Mm. Interesting. So, yeah. Will, are these spruce grouse, are we going to see them split again into two species? Or?
I haven't heard the word on spruce grouse. The American
genetics.
Ornithologist Union just came out with their findings for this year, and there have been some new decisions made. I'll have to bring in a copy of that article. Maybe we can talk about it next show. Some changes in taxonomy that have occurred. The AOU is kind of a funny institution. Mm-hmm. I think it kind of has become very well known because of the interest of the birding community.
Right.
And so taxonomy is a lot more variable in the bird world than most other described species because of so much personal interest. It's such a widespread hobby and interest of Americans and Europeans.
Well, interesting. Well, we'll find out more about that, and maybe we can find about some genetics of this
very
fascinating family of birds, the gallinaceous birds,
mm-hmm.
the grouse and ptarmigans.
They are.
And it's interesting to look at that history. So the most common one, I think, that we see here, at least in the high country, the spruce grouse, the small, I think it's a very beautiful bird,
mm-hmm.
a very funny bird, tries to avoid you, and the chicks will do the same thing. You'll see the young in this time of year and see a lot of them. So.
Yeah, and I forgot one interesting trait about them. They do seem to be in the high country here, and these grouse, spruce grouse, are more higher latitudes. They are what do they call them? Booted, so they have feathers all the way down their legs to their feet. So they need that extra insulation, and just kind of another interesting adaptation of the Franklin's grouse.
All right,
okay, Gary. Well, should we move into a little more music?
Yeah, let's do some music.
Okay,
and that gives me time to do our duties and check all the right dials and making sure that we're broadcasting at the right levels.
This is KRFP Radio Free Moscow.
Riding on the city of New Orleans, Illinois Central, Monday morning rail. 15 cars and 15 restless riders, 3 conductors and 25 sacks on mail. All along the southbound Odyssey, the train pulled out at Kankakee and rolls along past houses, farms, and fields. Passing trains that have no name, and graveyards full of old black men, and the graveyards of the rusted automobile. Good morning. Pass the paper bag that holds the bottle. Feel the wheels rumbling beneath the floor. And the sons of Pullman porters and the sons of engineers ride their father's magic carpet made of steel. Mothers with their babe asleep, rocking to the gentle beat, and the rhythm of the rails is all they feel. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. Darkness rolling down to the sea. But all the towns and people seem to fade into a bad dream, and the steel rails still ain't heard the news. The conductor sings his songs again, the passengers will please refrain. This train has got the disappearing railroad blues. Good morning, America, how are you? Say, don't you know me? I'm your native son. I'm the train they call the city of New Orleans. I'll be gone 500 miles when the day is done.
Back.
And Will, yeah, we are back. And I thought maybe this is a good time to do our usual disclaimer.
Yes.
To make sure the radio station doesn't get into trouble by having a couple of wild men here on
That's
the air.
Right.
That, of course, the views don't represent any organization or necessarily the views of KRFP. Just simply those of a couple of individuals
That's
and any
right.
guests that we have to interview.
Yeah. That's kind of nice. I like
that is nice, though. Mm-hmm. That's a great thing about community radio is it allows people to do that.
Yep.
Well, Will, I think we ought to talk about a peak and have our little feature. And I don't have any music to go with it. How's that? There, the little trumpet sound there. The peak of the week.
Peak of the week.
We've been all over the Wild Clearwater country. And this week we're going to head down south again, and in fact we're going to do a little poaching, although it's still within what we call the Wild Clearwater region, reaching just right out of the watershed boundary into some of the Salmon River country, although north of that main stem of the Salmon River, it's still in the Nez Perce National Forest, so we consider it part of the Wild Clearwater country. And this peak is not a prominent one. It's not one that most people know about, although it's relatively high. It's deep in the backcountry. It should be part of the wilderness, though it's not. And it's not a steep peak. It's not one of those jagged mountains you might see, like the Selway Crags or some of the famous mountains in Idaho to the south, the Sawtooths, perhaps the epitome of jagged mountains here in the lower 48. And it's not a big rocky mountain like those, with cliffs and snow faces on. In fact, it tends to be forested all the way to the top. But it does have a little bit of opening in it, and you can see some pretty amazing views, although somewhat obscured by the lodgepole pine. The stands aren't super thick up there. They're some relatively open lodgepole in places, with that nice understory of bear grass and, of course, grass whortleberry. This mountain is over 6,000 feet in elevation, and in fact, it's closer to 7,000 feet. It's 6,687 feet high. So it gets up there a ways. It's not a tiny mountain. And up top you get there, you see some of the changes that take place. You'll find some spruce up top there mixed in with the lodgepole coming in. And off to kind of to the north and to the east, sometimes you can get some views of some pretty nice wild country. And the way you find this mountain is you have to go down to a very famous or infamous place in north central Idaho environmental history. You go into the Cove Mallard area.
Ooh.
Right in the middle of the Cove Roadless area is Churchill Mountain. And that's our peak of the week. There's a trail right by Dixie. In fact, it's just right after you go through the little downtown area. You could park there. You'll see a little teeny sign just beyond the Outfitters there. I think it's just on the other side of the just on the south side of the Outfitters little building there. I think it's just on the south side. It could be the north side. Got a visual image there. But pulling off there, and you head out, you cross the little creek there, and right across the landing strip there in Dixie, Idaho and Blaine Creek. And then you just head east, and you go up the ridge, and then down into Rhett Creek, and then you begin the climb, because Churchill Mountain's on a big ridge that extends all the way from the north of Dixie to down almost, you know, to the breaks of the Salmon River. And when you get in there, you realize you're in really wild country. It's maybe 4 miles, 5 miles in to hit the peak of Churchill. The peak, and it's like I say, it's sort of a misnomer, kind of a big round mountain. But off the east, there is a bit of a drop off there, and you can see some of that wild country that extends on that big wedge of green that goes down to the Salmon River, that Cove Mallard region, which is not as steep as most of that Salmon River canyon. The breaks there aren't as steep, and the peaks around them aren't as high for the most part. And so you have this nice wedge of green, and there it is, Churchill Mountain, rather diverse area. It's not, like I say, the big rocky, craggy, steep country, so therefore it translates into pretty good country for elk and other wildlife species that don't like the crags. And so pretty nice country. Wolves down there. I've seen wolf sign down there right after reintroduction. And I started a trip several years ago. I spent about 3 weeks in the Frank Church River No Return Wilderness, and we started out in Cove Mallard, which the Cove Mallard area is an area conservationists have always wanted to be added to the River of No Return Wilderness. So Churchill Mountain overlooks the Salmon River Breaks country, overlooks Little Mallard Creek, and headwaters of Rhett Creek are on that ridge, on the Churchill Mountain ridge up there. So that's our peak of the week, some wild country, not as one of those craggy, jaggedy peaks, but a spectacular place nonetheless, and somewhat typical of the large north-central Idaho wild country in that it has a feeling of bigness, an immense country, of big country when you're in it, and you really are, because you are within, although on sort of on the edge, you are within the largest roadless area in the lower 48 states when you're on Churchill Mountain.
All right. Sounds like a great place.
And it's a great place to see those fool's hens.
Bruce All Sprouse. Right.
Oh, yeah. I've seen them up there just about every time I go. So.
Well, let's see, Gary.
We're getting close to
Yeah, we are. Maybe we should just... We'll probably talk about this for a while.
We will for a while. So yeah. Maybe we ought to do it. There we go.
Whopper of the week time. Okay. This week's Whopper comes to you courtesy of the Environmental Protection Agency. An article in yesterday's Lewiston Morning Tribune. EPA okay spraying pesticides over waters.
Ooh.
Which is kind of bad in and of itself, but it gets worse. The Bush administration pleased farmers and frustrated environmentalists Monday by declaring that pesticides can be sprayed into and over waters without first obtaining special permits. The heavily lobbied decision is supposed to settle a dispute that's roiled federal courts and divided state regulators. And this is supposedly popular among those who spray pesticides for a living, but worries those who fear poisoned waters will result. Well, how did they pull this off? Well, they did something we like to call doublespeak. and they did it by altering the definition of the word pollutant. The EPA decision gave the pest operators what they wanted by changing the definition of this one word. EPA officials concluded that a pesticide, when it's deliberately applied, is not a pollutant under the terms of the 1972 Clean Water Act.
That's ridiculous.
Consequently, after considering nearly 700 public comments, officials ruled that federal discharge permits aren't necessary when using pesticides to control waterborne pests. So they've changed the meaning of this word, that when you do it, when you use it deliberately, it's no longer a pollutant.
Oh, so if I go out and start a car, I'm deliberately starting the car, and there's plenty of research that shows the impacts of burning gasoline in an internal combustion engine and having those pistons go up and down and what goes out the tailpipe. Can I get a waiver and not have to have the pollution control devices on my car because they are no longer pollutants because I'm deliberately doing it and I know what's coming out that other end?
Unbelievable.
I guess now if I go out and poison somebody. I really haven't poisoned them, have I?
Not if it was deliberate.
If it was a deliberate action, I go out there. So that poor Russian...
That's right.
...spy, that former spy, you should say, that was not poisoned by polonium, this very rare radioactive element. Since it was deliberate, it maybe wasn't such a bad thing. I mean, this is ridiculous. So
yeah.
It's a deliberate action.
Yeah.
It's not... It doesn't cause harm. It's not...
It's
what
just,
kind of crazy thinking is that?
Yeah, I can't even get over it. It's so typical of the administration with the Clear Skies Act and the Healthy Forests Act and
Now pollution's not pollution if you tend to do it.
That's right. That's right. Pollutant actually carries with it a connotation of deliberate action. That's what they're saying. I wonder if Webster will pick up on this and they'll change their ways.
Change pollutant. So is this a byproduct as something that you didn't intend to do?
Right.
Well, everybody can get off on this. Just think now, every single polluter can say they intended to put that into the waterway. So any factory now that is discharging things can claim now they don't need an NPDES permit.
Right.
To discharge.
So if they're blatant, intentional polluters, they get rewarded.
Right. They can say.
But only the blatant ones. If you accidentally do it, don't tell anyone, because then you're breaking the law.
Then you're breaking the law.
Right.
But it's an accident. But if it's by intent, then you're not.
Right? Oh, man. So, this is really messy.
So now, wait a minute. So you can put your pipe into the water, your outlet pipe, uh-huh. and say, we intend to put it there.
Yes.
So you're okay. So it can continue to be there. But just this basically ends, or could end, any enforcement of the Clean Water Act. It's ridiculous. I expect it to be challenged at some time in court, and I think a judge is going to have to look at this definition of a pollutant, because it doesn't apply to a pesticide. You know, that is a pollutant. Now, what happens now if you have extra toxic pesticides and you want now to get rid of them? So you send them down the drain, which is probably deliberately. It's probably contrary to the labeling instructions on them, but now it's no longer, since it's not a pollutant, it's okay. So the EPA has radically altered, I think, licensing now and application of pesticides and herbicides. You can spray them on water, it's just fine, since it's deliberate. You can deliberately flush the waste down the drain, since that's deliberate. You can deliberately do, you know, to get rid of them, you stick them in the water, so it's not a problem. That's the most ridiculous. I guess a municipality could say we intend, you know, since, water runs downhill and so does other byproducts, maybe human byproducts, they run, certain things run downhill, therefore it's intentional. We know that.
It's just
what were they?
The.
I mean, this is the one of the weirdest, most blatant double speaks I've ever heard. I mean,
this kind of culture of deception is so well, I guess, observed and popular now that it's okay as long as you explain yourself. If you explain yourself, it's okay to deceive whoever you want. Well, as long as you make it make sense grammatically.
Okay, now, or you can do something wrong,
mm-hmm.
as long as you intend to do it. I wonder, just think if this applies to other forms of jurisprudence. If I want to go and steal something, it's really not stealing, because I intend to do it. It's not stealing, so it's not stolen goods. It's... I intended it.
So
the
only people who would be punished for wrongdoing are the klutzes and accident prone of the world.
That's right.
Because they would only do things like that accidentally.
Exactly. Now, if you get into an accident, and it is by accident, but if you intended to plow the car into the person walking across a crosswalk, then it's not an accident. And so, therefore, you're not. Oh.
Yeah. So this decision came from the EPA. Let's see if they have a hitman here. No, they didn't. They didn't mention anyone specifically. So we have to slap them with a whopper for the agency.
Whole agency.
The whole agency. Yeah.
Well, that is well deserved. I mean, if there's ever been a well deserved whopper, that's one.
Yeah, and this really makes things easier for people. Like folks involved in the Fresno Mosquito and Vector Control District, it will make things a little less messy. It means we can continue to do what we have done for years without additional permitting requirements. So I think in the light, especially of this past year, findings that even Roundup, which has long been hailed by the chemical industry
as benign,
safe, as benign, its impacts on not only amphibians but also human fetuses,
mm-hmm.
I think in the light of that kind of evidence, this should be this should go nowhere.
It should go nowhere. All right. Well, Whopper. A well-deserved Whopper.
Well-deserved.
Well, Will, we've just about done it.
We have. Oh, and I had an update on that that meeting on growth. The Moscow meeting on growth and urban development in Moscow next Monday, December 4th from 4 to 6 p.m. Latah County Courthouse.
Is in the basement room?
Yeah, always in room 2B. Most 2B. Things happen
so
down
it's in
there
room 2B in the basement of the county courthouse about growth in Latah County and Moscow.
Moscow specifically.
It's just Moscow.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. But
I think they'll probably take into account Latah County.
Oh, that's odd because I thought the county didn't have anything to do with the city. So that's an interesting jurisdictional question. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there you have it.